We're going to look at this miracle together. We started back in September a new sort of series looking at the first four chapters of John's eyewitness testimony about Jesus. We took a little break, and we're coming back to chapter two for the next couple of weeks, exploring more about who Jesus is, why he came, what it means to trust him. You might remember, if you're here, that John says, right at the end of his eyewitness testimony, that he wrote it so that people would understand who Jesus is, would understand what trusting him means, and would understand what would result of trusting in him would be. We saw in chapter 1 that Jesus is the maker of everything, and yet he came and slept under the stars that he'd made. That God became man in Christ, that God stepped into our humanity to make himself known. We saw that's who Jesus is. And really in chapter 2, and particularly in chapter 2, Jesus begins to hint at why he's done that. What his mission is, if you like, what he's all about, and that's what we're going to see. This week we're going to look at this wedding miracle, and then next week Jesus clearing the temple, getting angry. So it's like Jesus at a party celebrating, and then Jesus getting cross. Two sides of the same man, and it's an extraordinary chapter. And I invite you to come back and keep exploring with us who he is. But as we look at this chapter, I don't know if you're a fan of The Apprentice. I'm sad to say that I am. I quite enjoy looking at other people and making myself feel better. just think, goodness me, people are that sad. How happy I am. But in The Apprentice, in the final week, what these young entrepreneurs have to do is they have to launch their product, and all the previously fired candidates are welcomed back, and the two teams, they're sort of the initial 12 or however many it is that start the apprentice, the two teams are there, and it's time to launch the product. And they spend their 2 days planning with precision, well, that's the intention, how to launch their products. Every detail is agonized over. Every word that is to be spoken at the presentation is thought of carefully to make sure that Lord Sugar and everyone listening understands what it is that's on the table. Will he invest? Every detail controlled and planned, right down to the last detail. Jesus' miracle at this wedding is like his apprentice final. It's his calling card. It's his first miracle. John has been at pains to tell us through chapter 1 that this is Jesus' first week of his ministry. And this is the last day of that week. This is the seventh day recorded. This is the first miracle that he does. His first public display. And although it's a familiar story, the water into wine, familiar in outside of Christian circles, I guess, it's familiarity, I think, we lose something of what's going on. Jesus here, he doesn't feed the hungry. He doesn't raise the dead. He doesn't heal the leper. He doesn't make the paralyzed man walk. No, he keeps the party going. And I don't know if you noticed in the text, actually only a few people see that a miracle has been performed. The master of ceremonies who announces that this is the best wine, he has no idea a miracle's taken place. He just thinks this bridegroom who should have provided it has been extremely generous. So only Jesus' mother, the disciples, probably the servants who drew the water out of the jars, though that's up for question as well, really know that something significant has happened. And yet, look down at verse 11. John's recorded it, Because John wants us to see that this is the first of the signs through which Jesus revealed his glory. Through which, this is the first thing that Jesus does to show, this is what I'm about. This is what I'm about. Jesus sets his stall out. And it's a puzzle, isn't it? Why is providing wine, however miraculous it is, why is providing wine at a wedding banquet the thing that Jesus does to set his public ministry going? This is what I want people to know I'm about. So three questions that we need to ask, to puzzle over together, if you like. Three questions. What has he come to bring? What does the water into wine thing signify? Because that's what John says. It's a signal of something. What does he come to bring? What does it signify? Why does he need to do it? And how will it be accomplished? Three questions that I'd love us to puzzle over together. So what has he come to bring? Well, just simply, he's come to bring the party. He's come to bring the party. Jesus uses all of his supernatural power as the Lord of the universe to sustain the festivities, to keep the party going. Perhaps some have said, look down at verse number six. Jesus picks the ceremonial washing jars and tells them to fill those with water. Now, those jars, it's thought that the seven of them together would probably hold as much as 180 gallons of water. So this is not Jesus, you know, bringing a bottle to share at the evening meal. This is abundant provision for this party, 180 gallons. And this is not the wine that I used to drink on the park with my mates when I was 15. Like, this is not Lambrusco. This is the good stuff, isn't it? The master of the ceremonies is amazed. It's like, normally people bring out the cheap wine when everyone's had their fill, but you've saved the best of wines until now. This is the good stuff. So what's Jesus doing? What's he doing? Well, Jesus is saying, I've come to bring festival joy. If you want to know what I'm about, he says, I'm the Lord of the feast. My coming means the party can begin. I don't know what you think about Christianity or Christians. If you take your image of what Christianity is, or what people like me are, people who are paid to talk to churches, you'd be forgiven for thinking that sort of wet, kind of weak, maybe a little bit dodgy kind of characters who lament that the world is dreadful. Always banging on about sin and suffering. That to become a Christian is to become melancholy, to take some kind of miserable pill or something like that. A good friend of mine, a non-Christian friend of mine, laments that church seems to be like that. It's just dull and boring and has no life. Christianity is for people who can't cope with life, can't cope with the struggle, and so have to find something to help them. Well, this miracle says to that kind of idea, it's just wrong. That Jesus come to bring the party. It's why we chose those three songs to open up our service with this morning. Songs that help us to celebrate who Jesus is and what he's come to do. Christianity is not for grumblers. Christianity shouldn't be for the Eeyores amongst us. Jesus turned the water into wine. The wine he did not turn into water. Although some Christians you'd be think that he probably should have done. You see, we saw in chapter 1 that the Lord in creation stepped into his world as he promised. And now he says, the reason I've come is to bring the party. To fill the world with festival joy. People think that Jesus here is fulfilling or hinting towards that he is about to fulfill one of the great Old Testament promises written some 700 years before Jesus came. It goes like this. It's from the book of Isaiah. And Isaiah writes this about the future that's coming. On this mountain, says Isaiah, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all people, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove his people's disgrace from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. In that day they will say, surely this is our God. We trusted in him and he saved us. This is the Lord. We trusted him. Let us rejoice and be glad in this salvation. See what Jesus is doing? Turning the water into wine. He's saying to his disciples, my first miracle, my calling card miracle, is to signify that I've come to bring about that future. I'm coming to bring about that new creation, that to bring that festival joy. Friends, Jesus is saying to each one of us this morning that every wedding feast that you've been to, every family meal that you've enjoyed, every evening of laughter around a table with friends, all those hints of those joyful things is just a shadow of what Jesus has come to do. It's just a shadow. Jesus is saying every tear you've shed over a great happy ending in a book or a film is your heart tasting the happy ending you were made to enjoy. That's why we love happy endings. Because that's what we're made for, the greatest of happy endings. And Jesus says, I'm coming to bring it. So here Jesus is setting his stall out. This is what I'm all about. I'm the Lord of the feast. I've come to bring the party. Now, as I say that, I know that for some in our congregation, this week, particularly this week, has been extremely, extremely painful. I know that there's certainly a couple here that this week has been a week of profound loss. It's been a week of frustration or disappointment. For some, it's been a week of feeling hurt. Maybe some of you here are just, you sat here fighting back the tears. Jesus says, I've come to wipe them away. That's what he's doing in this miracle. He said, I've come to wipe them away. That's what I'm about. I've come to straighten out everything that's crooked and wrong. Don't mishear me, though, this morning. I'm not saying that means you shouldn't grieve, that life isn't painful. Jesus is not undermining the things that happen to us. He's saying, as kind of another writer in the New Testament says later in the New Testament, he says, we're not to grieve as those that have no hope. Like beneath the tears and beneath the anguish, that all that life throws at us is a deep joy that everything sad will become untrue. That's what Jesus is promising in this miracle. Everything sad will become untrue. One writer has said that, talking about this passage, that something so glorious is coming that it will make all that has happened to us feel like one night in a bad hotel. It's come to bring festival joy. Come to bring festival joy. Maybe some of you just need to hear that this morning. You just need to just turn on your own right now and just say, Jesus, help me to taste. Help me to taste something of what you've promised here. But for some here this morning, and I think for me, I think this miracle just demands that we dream bigger. Calling us to dream bigger. Listen to the masterful C.S. Lewis in his essay, The Weight of Glory. It's a bit wordy, forgive that, but it's too good to not read all of it, all of the quote anyway. He writes, nature is mortal. We shall outlive her. When all the suns and nebulae have passed away, each one of you will still be alive. Nature is only the image, the symbol. We are summoned to pass in through nature, beyond her, into that splendor which she fitfully reflects. And in there, in beyond nature, we shall eat of the tree of life. He's saying that there's something about nature, something so powerful that demands that we look beyond it, beyond the stuff, beyond the material stuff, that it demands that we look beyond it because of who God is and what he's done. He goes on, the faint, far-off results of those energies which God's creative rapture implanted in matter when he made the worlds are what we now call physical pleasures. And even thus filtered, they're too much for our present management. What would it be to taste at the fountainhead, that stream of which even these lower reaches prove so intoxicating? Yet that, I believe, is what lies before us. The whole man is to drink from the fountain of joy. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered to us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. He's right, we're far too easily pleased. If only we knew what Jesus is offering here in this miracle, we'd see that the extent of our dreams, they're so small, they're so boring, they're so dull, they're so self-contained. Like if your dream here is retiring to a big house so you can enjoy your grandchildren, friends, that's so dull. If your dream here is, I just want the job that will pay all the money without any of the difficulty. Friends, dream bigger. Dream bigger. Stop dreaming about winning the lottery so you can sit back and relax. So boring. All that stuff, it will just sit by your graveside as you lie in the grave. You won't take it with you. Some of you are sat here just saying, if I could just get out of this circumstance, then life would be comfortable. If I could just get rid of it. Friends, you see, deeply ingrained within each of us is the assumption that this life, this world is all that there is, and so we better squeeze everything out of it. We deeply believe that. It's why we get cross in a traffic jam, because someone's got in my way. It's why any difficulty that comes at us is devastating, because it interrupts my quest for happiness now. We look at the things around us, we think that that's all there is, but it's not. We're going to outlive the stuff. That's what Jesus is saying in this miracle. We're going to outlive the stuff. I read of the tragic story a couple of weeks ago now, of a 32-year-old chap called Daniel Fleetwood, who is a big fan of the Star Wars films. And really tragically, he's been diagnosed with a cancer that's just really, really aggressive. And it's unlikely that he's going to make the screening when it's released on the 18th of December. And his friends have set up this big petition to Disney to release the film early so that he can go and see it before he dies. Just one more experience. Just another Star Wars movie. And then I can go. It's just tragic, isn't it? And Jesus says in this miracle, he says, I've come to bring festival joy. I've come to wipe away your tears. That's my calling card. That's what I'm about. So that's what he's come to bring. But why does he need to bring it? Surely everyone gets to heaven, right? Why does he need to get people to trust in him? Well, it's worth noticing down in verse 6 and 7 that Jesus, the detail John gives us is that, and what Jesus does is fills these ceremonial jars that are normally used for washing. This isn't where the wine is kept normally. Jesus deliberately chooses these ceremonial washing jars. See, in the Old Testament, the Jewish people, they had many rites and rituals. Lots of it involved washing. And the point of all of those rituals was the acknowledgement that you can't just walk into God's presence as we are. We can't just join the party as we are. We need cleaning. We need washing. We need to be transformed. It's important to remember as well that in this culture, This was a shame-honour culture, which we don't really understand in our individualistic Western world, but a shame-honour culture, running out of wine at the party when you're responsible for it would bring real dishonour to this bridegroom, to this couple. It's thought that there are probably legal obligations in providing for the banquet. So this wedding of this young couple is about to turn from, you know, did you go, wasn't it brilliant, to did you go? They ran out of wine. How dreadful. This is a very public shaming that's about to come their way. And so this is what Jesus rescues them from. He's come to bring joy by taking away the shame. That's what the miracle does. It's not just a demonstration of power. He rescues this couple from public disgrace. Ed Welch, in his book, Shame Interrupted, defines shame as this. He says, shame is the deep sense that you are unacceptable because of something you did, something done to you, or something associated with you. You feel exposed and humiliated. He goes on to say, shame shows itself in the disgust you feel when you look in the mirror at your own body. Shame shows itself in the need to be right all the time. I can't be wrong. Shame shows itself in our grumbling, our need to be critical of others to cover up for our own failings. Shame shows itself in the lies you tell to cover up so that you're not exposed. It shows itself in the anger that you have that keeps other people at arm's length. Shame says, I'm not the person I know, I'm not the person I should be, and I cannot bear the idea of people knowing that about me. That's what shame is. Shame wants the house to always be spotless. Shame wants the kids to be well-behaved in public. Shame means I never share honestly about who I am. I never let people into my life. See, we're not familiar with the language of shame, but it's us, isn't it? That's us. That's what we're like. We're full of shame. And look what Jesus does for this about-to-be-shamed couple. He brings them honour. They don't get exposed. They get honoured. They get honoured despite their failure. Shame is what we feel when we see how dark our hearts are. When we begin to glimpse what they have been capable of in the past, when we're reminded of past failings, or maybe what they might be given the opportunity, what they might be capable of. But Jesus uses all his power in this miracle to protect the bridegroom, at least, from being shamed publicly. Transforms him from this public shaming that's coming to being publicly honoured. See, Jesus, in choosing for his first miracle to use those washing pots to rescue this couple, Jesus points what it will be like for his people on the festival day that he's promised to bring. He's come to wash us clean. He's come to bring us honour rather than shame. It's remarkable. I remember lots of wonderful things about my wedding day with Katie, being surrounded by my closest friends and family, and a heap of people I'd never met or seen since, bizarrely. Maybe that was your experience of your wedding too. But when I think back to that day, there's two things I remember. On the negative, I didn't get any of the hog roast. I can tell you about that story later. But the big thing, it's a bit soppy, I know. The big thing is just seeing Katie walk down the aisle. And the promise of this miracle, Jesus says, that's how I'm going to feel about my people one day. I'm going to make them sparkle. I'm not just going to put a dress on them. I'm going to transform them from the inside, and I'm going to make them sparkle. And I'm going to be like the bridegroom at the front of the church, just can't wait to marry his bride. It's a wonderful, wonderful miracle that Jesus says, this is what I'm about. I've come to bring the party just by taking away your shame. Friends, you might feel dirty this morning inside. You might feel like, for all that I look on the external, if people knew my heart, they wouldn't want to sit next to me. I don't know if you've ever wondered why or how it is that nightclub owners get people out of the building. How is it they do it? Just turn the lights on. Turn the lights on. There's something about light in those places that people go, I think it's time to go. This is not that great, really, is it? Friends, one day Jesus is going to turn the lights on. And everything hidden is just going to, it's going to be seen for what it is. All will be laid bare. You won't be able to hide. And Jesus says to those that come to him, when the lights come on, you will sparkle. You will be radiant. There'll be nothing to be ashamed of. You'll be honored. That's what Jesus says. That's what my miracle, that's what I'm about. Bringing festival joy to those that don't deserve it. It's a remarkable miracle, isn't it? There's nothing to fear when the lights come on. But how can that be? How can it be? Because we know we're shameful, don't we? We know it. We know there are things in our past, things in our present that we're just desperate to hide. How can it be that Jesus does that? How can he make us sparkle? There's a bigger problem than running out of wine in our lives, isn't there? Well, there's one more puzzle in this story. I don't know if you noticed it there towards the start. The puzzle is in how rude Jesus seems to be towards his mother. Jesus and his mother have been invited to the wedding because they, family, friends or whatever, part of the community. And Mary notices that they're about to run out of wine, and turning to her son, knowing that he might be able to do something about it, she says, Jesus, they're about to run out of wine. Go and do something. It's not clear that she's expecting him to do anything miraculous. That's not clear in the text. It's just, you're the son, you do something. Concerned for their reputation, she turns to Jesus for help. And Jesus says, woman, look down at verse 4, why do you involve me? My hour has not yet come. It's a puzzle, isn't it? Like gentle Jesus, meek and mild, slightly rude to his mum. What's he saying? What does Jesus mean? Why the rebuke? Well, the hour in this account of Jesus' life, if you read all the way through it, Jesus' hour, it always refers to his death. His crucifixion, which happens in towards the end of the book. In fact, it occupies the second half of the book, really. So the next puzzle is, if that's what Jesus has got in his mind, he's at this wedding with everything going on, and all he can think about is his death. Like, why is he thinking about his death at this banquet where he's providing a feast? And what's going on? Well, one writer poses this question. He says this, what is it that single people think about at weddings? They think about their own wedding. They're looking beyond the current bride and groom to their own day. You know, what hymns would I choose? What cake would I have? What flower arrangement would I make? And all the rest of it. And he suggests that Jesus is looking past his mother, past this bride and groom, and he's looking far away. And he can't help but think about his death. Ed Clowney, speaking on this passage, says this, that Jesus is sat amidst all the joy, sipping the coming sorrow. That's what he's doing. You see, Jesus knew for the party to continue, for the shame to be taken away from his people, he had to die. Jesus is kind of saying in that sentence, I think, that for my people to fall into my arms, for that future wedding day that I've spoken about to happen, for them to fall into my arms on the wedding day, and for my people to drink the cup of joy and festival blessing, I'm going to have to drink the cup of punishment and death. I'm going to have to bleed for my bride. Ed Clowney's quote continues. He says, Jesus sat amidst all the joy of the wedding feast, sipping the coming sorrow, so that today you and I who believe in him can sit amidst all this world's sorrow, sipping the coming joy. It's a remarkable miracle because it means that, friends, whatever you're facing this morning, because of Jesus, you can sip the coming joy. You can sip the coming joy because he's drunk down the shame that you deserve, that you know you deserve. He was stripped naked on the cross so that you might be clothed in his beautiful life. So as we turn to sing in a minute, if you're hurting this morning, if you feel angry this morning, he doesn't promise that those things will go away as you sing. He's not saying forget about it, just sing. He's saying you can sip the coming joy even in the grief. So sing loudly. Things still hurt. They hurt deeply. But as we turn to sing, it's why we sing as Christians, because we can sip the coming joy. Or if you feel your shame deeply this morning, if you feel like God has just been saying to you, I know the depths of your heart, then you can still sing. Because we sing of one who's taken away our shame. Even if you hate your voice, even if you can't bear the sound of your own singing voice, and rightly for some of you, that's true, I've heard them, you can still sing. You can still sing. You've got to sing because he's come to bring festival joy by taking away your shame. You can still sing. Push the joy of the gospel deep into your heart. Sing and make melody in your heart this morning, because the Prince of Heaven not only slept under the stars that he's made, but he lost his home with his father. He was stripped naked on a cross so he could rescue his bride and make her beautiful and join her in that future wedding banquet when everything sad really will become untrue. Friends, he promises to wipe away your tears. Just think about that. He's going to wipe them away. It's going to be so intimate, he'll take his thumb and he'll just wipe them away. So it's okay. I've done it. I've sorted it out. No more death. No more goodbyes. No more panic in the night. No more sleepless nights. No more early mornings wondering what the day's going to hold. Something so glorious, it's just going to be like one night in a bad hotel. Let's pray together.